This is a Reconstructionist radio production. Please visit GaryNorth.com/freebooks for a PDF download of this and many other great Christian books. Backward Christian Soldiers, an action manual for Christian Reconstruction by Gary North, copyright 1984, published by Institute for Christian Economics, narrated by Alan Bailey. Part 3, Strategy. Chapter 11. The stalemate mentality. Those who go into battle expecting defeat are soon defeated. On December 7, 1941, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. As one ship sat burning in the harbor, its anti-aircraft guns blazing at the incoming waves of planes, a chaplain reportedly began assisting the gunners and was heard to shout, "Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition." This phrase was turned into a popular patriotic song of the Second World War. The chorus ended, "Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition and we'll all stay free." It was this vision of men's responsibilities that motivated British and American forces. Churchill's blood, sweat, and tears speech, actually he had said blood, sweat, toil, and tears, delivered a similar message. The assurance of victory, at first in a defensive battle, but ultimately offensively. The Allies were determined to carry the war to the enemy's front door and then knock down the door. It would not be easy, but it would be done. Pusan or Incheon. In June of 1950, the North Korean Army attacked South Korea. The poorly equipped South Korean Army, outnumbered 2-1, collapsed immediately. Half of its 65,000 men were killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. President Syngman Rhee, age 75, and General Douglas MacArthur, age 74, who had flown in from Japan, watched the final rout from the front lines. Seoul, the South Korean capital, fell in 4 days. America flew in the Army's 24th and 25th Divisions from Japan. Inexperienced, poorly trained, and poorly equipped, they retreated for 6 weeks until they were trapped on the southern tip of Korea, the Pusan Peninsula. Some American troops had surrendered at first until they learned how few prisoners the North Koreans took. It looked as if MacArthur's troops would be pushed into the sea. Finally, the Americans and South Koreans dug in, and a stalemate ensued. A chunk of land south of 120-mile strip across the southern tip of Korea was all that remained of free South Korea. Now what? MacArthur had an idea. Why not launch an invasion at the port of Incheon, 24 miles west of Seoul and 150 miles from the rear of the North Korean forces? It was considered impossible to complete an amphibious landing at Incheon. MacArthur knew what military experts believed, so he decided to attempt it. The element of surprise was crucial. The 1st Marine Division was secretly shipped in from San Francisco, and on September the 15th, the invasion began. It was over the day it started. The American forces cut the North Koreans off from behind, and within 2 weeks, the North Koreans were defeated. Half were in prison of war camps, the rest were cut off in small units or trying to flee home. The war did not end, of course. The Chinese Communists invaded with a large force of 300,000 men in late November. MacArthur had been caught off guard despite warning signs. The Chinese had done to him what he had done to the North Koreans. It was the worst military defeat of his career. He learned firsthand what he had taught. There is no respite during a war. The war goes on until one side wins. The 1st Marine Division was cut off and surrounded. They had attacked the Chinese from the rear since they had been 40 miles to the north when the Chinese hit the 8th Army. But the Chinese had anticipated the Marines' attack and cut them off. The Marines then broke out of the trap. Lieutenant General Walton Walker, the Marine commander, uttered the classic line of the Korean War, which later became the title of a movie about the war. When asked by a reporter if he was retreating, he responded, "Retreat, hell. We're only attacking in a different direction." Colonel Lewis B. Chesty Puller almost matched Walker's line. "The enemy is in front of us, behind us, to the left of us, and to the right of us. They won't escape this time." They hacked their way out for 14 days through blizzards and thousand-foot chasms. See William Manchester, The Glory and the Dream. Bug-out fever. Why all this military history in a book about religion? Because we are still in a war. From time to time a truce breaks out. No one is fooled except the Christians. The old fundamentalism's equivalents of the State Department, seminaries, non-denominational magazines, old-line campus evangelism ministries, gospel quartets, prophetic tape ministries, and paperback devotional books by housewives keep informing us that the real battle to come is not for us, that the tribulation is for the Jews, and victory is post-tribulation. Today's battle cry, pray for a stalemate. The largest Christian army on the field is an army of insurance salesmen selling eternal fire insurance policies to the terminal generation. The troops are all looking forward to R&R, not rest and recreation, but rapture and restoration. They suffer from all the affliction first described at Pusan, bug-out fever. In 1950, American troops trapped at Pusan wanted to get back to Japan. Today, the Christian troops want to bug out to heaven before enemy forces launch the Great Tribulation. Those who promote the last outpost perspective are divided. Some believe that the last outpost will end with the return of Christ and his angels in final judgment. Conclusion: not a single non-ecclesiastical institution we build today will survive the final onslaught of the enemy, which precedes Christ's victorious return. The other major viewpoint teaches that Christ will return to set up an international chain of command with headquarters in Jerusalem. God's angels, a kind of heavenly first airborne division, will relieve us of command, letting us bug out for our long-awaited R&R. When we return in our perfect physical bodies, it will be desk jobs, PX prices, and field-grade commissions for all of us, and hard times for spiritual gooks, wogs, and fuzzy-wuzzies everywhere for 1,000 years. We all know one thing. We're in Pusan. We are trapped on the peninsula, and the enemy is at the bridges or gates, as the case may be. Christians know that humanists control the Congress, the President, the big three TV networks, the prestige universities, the public schools, except, you understand, local public schools attended by 90% of the children of the mainline denominations, where 30% of the faculty and the assistant football coach are Baptist, and it doesn't matter who writes the textbooks, so go team go. The news media, except, of course, the local newspaper, which is owned by a Presbyterian elder, and it doesn't matter who writes the AP or UPI stories. The social welfare committees of every denomination of more than 15,000 members, the oil companies, big business, big labor, and the big foundations. What do Christians control? The Right to Life movement, the temperance movement, half a dozen four-year colleges, and several satellite TV networks, and possibly as many as 14 small-town branches of the YMCA. This is Pusan. Will we break out or bug out? General MacArthur had the right idea, the Incheon landing. General Walker also had the right idea, attacking in a different direction. Senior officers do not go into battle expecting to surrender or to be trapped in some enclave. Those who do go into battle expecting defeat are soon defeated. They spend the war in a POW camp or the Gulag Archipelago. Walking the point. In mid-September of 1982, Reverend Jerry Falwell devoted one broadcast of his old-time gospel hour to a report on the attacks he has sustained from the humanist media and humanist demonstrators. He showed film clips of placard-carrying protesters. He also showed filmed interviews with several of them. One group of protesters was parading in front of his church, and one of them carried a small cross with a dead frog nailed to it. The cross bore the inscription, "He died for your sins." To put it mildly, the protesters we saw were not people who inspire confidence. The object of the presentation was to raise money. The various ministries of the old-time gospel hour were under financial pressure, he reported. Giving was down, costs were up. With a 5,000-student college, the television programming cost, and all the other expenses, his ministry needs a continuing flood of money. The recession and the bad publicity had cut into people's giving, he reported. The way he chose to raise funds is a good one. Identify the common enemies. Provide visual proof of just how reprehensible the enemies are, the same thing humanists do when they run their full-page ads against the moral majority and related ministries. Books like Holy Terror, The Fundamentalist War on America's Freedoms in Religion, Politics, and Our Private Lives, Doubleday, 1982, and The New Subversion, Anti-Americanism of the Religious Right, Continuum, 1982. Pull no punches, but their humanist authors resent it when Falwell fights back for what he believes in. A recurring theme in his presentation was this: I am the point man in this battle. What is a point man? He is the soldier who walks ahead of the platoon, checking out the road, watching for the enemy, and drawing the first shots. He used another analogy, walking through the minefield. He might have used a third, a lightning rod. Someone has to walk the point, draw the initial fire, catch the flak. Jerry Falwell is the new Christian Right's point man. Obviously, most soldiers prefer not to walk the point. It's a dangerous position. There is nowhere to hide when you walk the point. This is the job which he has chosen, he said, and he is willing to continue. But, he said, he wants to know that others are behind him, that they will take a stand with him. No one wants to walk the point if the troops behind him have retreated. This leads me to the following observation. If he is going to survive the ordeal, the point man needs a team backing him up. But if the team is to be motivated to do this rather than bug out, the members need to have confidence. They need to trust their commanding officer, their non-commissioned officer, and their point man. They also need to trust their battle plan. A platoon that expects to be wiped out probably will be. No point man wants to walk the point in front of a discouraged platoon that is ready to cut and run at the first sign of gunfire. What impressed me about Reverend Falwell's appeal was this. He kept telling his viewers that victory is assured, that the forces of moral righteousness will not be defeated, that the United States is about to be turned around. Like a good company commander, he was talking victory. He was rallying the troops for a fight. He was not calling them to a losing battle. The electronic churchmen who are trying to rally Christians to take a stand have abandoned the language of premillennialism. Those who still cling tightly to the older faith are not calling their viewers to do anything risky or to take an unpleasant stand. The difference between the preaching of Howard C. Estep, "The King is Coming," and Jerry Falwell is striking. The latter has not officially abandoned the eschatology of the former, but unofficially he preaches a new gospel, a gospel of victory. When the new Christian right has discovered What the new Christian right has discovered is that if this society isn't redeemed, then we face a cultural crisis of major proportions. They have built up large followings, have amassed huge debts, and they now face political and ultimately religious pressures from the humanists who dominate the media and national politics. They see the need of fighting back. But they have learned an important truth. It is difficult to raise troops and money for a losing cause. It is easier for followers to stay home and play safe when it is a question of getting behind a point man in a self-professed losing cause. And the point men, like Falwell, who refuse to quit, now need to rally the troops. They are no longer calling for an enclave, for a perpetual stalemate. They are no longer content to remain bottled up on the Pusine Peninsula. No one needs a point man in a defensive operation anyway. Point men are offensive. They are used in breakouts. They are used to carry the war to the enemy. They are not used in defensive operations. By identifying himself as a point man, Jerry Falwell has been forced institutionally and financially to abandon the language of premillennial dispensationalism, whether he still believes it or not. He has adopted the language of victory. Christians are rallying to support Falwell and others like him who stand up and fight. In doing so, they are steadily abandoning premillennialism psychologically, if not officially. Older groups still cling to eschatologies of defeat. These groups are large, but they are dying. Their influence is shriveling up. People who have rallied for a battle do not want to hear tales of inevitable defeat from their commanders. The kind of theology represented by Hal Lindsey's books is fading. Those who believe Lindsey hope for peace in Pusan. They pray for a continuing stalemate, for they see persecution and external defeat as the only alternative to stalemate. But those people are not in the front lines of today's religious battles. Bug-out theology does not produce armies, only refugees. These people cannot serve as point men. Their theology will not produce a sustained battle, the kind of battle Christians are lining up for today. A stalemate is not good enough. MacArthur said it best, there is no substitute for victory. Chapter 12. What kind of army? An army which is told that it must suffer defeat, that any sign of victory is an illusion or else a lure into a subsequent defeat, that victory must be the devil's, will be a defeated army. Onward, Christian Soldiers is a favorite hymn of most people. It is far better known than Wayfaring Stranger, which begins, I am a poor wayfaring stranger, just traveling through this world of woe. Yet the sentiments of the vast majority of professing Christians are with the second song, despite the fact that they are not very poor and they are traveling in very fine style. The pilgrim motif is a lot more popular than the soldier motif. There are reasons for this. Christian, in John Bunyan's classic 17th century allegory, Pilgrim's Progress, was basically an unemployed drifter before he was converted and an unemployed traveler after. What did the man do for a living? Like the radio and television character of the 1940s and early 50s, Ozzie Nelson, he had no visible means of support, no calling. Ozzy, however, must have done something for a living, but Christian just plodded on and on through life. Bunyan, a wandering tinker for much of his life and imprisoned for most of the remainder, to some degree resembled Christian. But a tinker at least faced a market and delivered valuable services. Christian was, as far as we can see, a vagrant. This pilgrim motif stresses internal struggles over sin rather than struggles with external enemies. The soldier motif is the opposite. The soldier gains his self-confidence and skills in boot camp. After this initial training, he is assumed to be ready for battle. He concerns himself with the enemy, who is a true threat to his life. The pilgrim is more like a newly reformed alcoholic or a drug addict, going cold turkey. He wails, groans, writhes, struggles with inner horrors, and concentrates on what is going on inside him. He is at war with himself and his flesh, but not primarily at war with the external environment. The various allegorical characters in Pilgrim's Progress are external representations of internal enemies, vanity, doubt, despair, and so forth. The pilgrim does not bother much with his external environment, since he is only passing through. The soldier, on the other hand, is a conqueror, and he has to be concerned with what is going on around him. Perhaps the most detailed pilgrim manual is William Gurnall's The Christian in Complete Army, the 17th century book which devotes its 2,000 pages to a consideration of every conceivable personal temptation faced by the soul, except, unfortunately, the temptations of the battlefield. Gurnall did not involve himself in the theological battles of the day, which were literally life-and-death battles, and he signed the Act of Uniformity in 1662, thereby ensuring his continued income as a state-certified pastor, while 2,000 Puritan ministers refused to sign and were thrown out of their pulpits and in many cases into jail. Gurnall preferred a life of irrelevance, warring with his own internal lust, ignoring the external civil issues of his day. However harrowing his internal battles may have been, this pilgrim made his journey through the environment in comfort and relative safety. The battlefield. People get shot on battlefields. They get hurt. They aren't paid much, and what little they have is at perpetual risk. They can count on little from their external environment. They rely on their own wits, their past training, their experience under fire, their army supply systems, and most of all, the success of their commanding officer. The best executed battle plan can lead to disaster if it is not the appropriate battle plan. The stakes are high, yet the foot soldier must act in faith, obedient to his commanders, whether or not the plan is well designed. The chain of command must function all the time if it is to function at all. Cromwell's forces knew this, and they were nearly invincible on the battlefield. Cromwell was a military genius, an innovative cavalry officer, and a forceful leader of men. They trusted his military skills. They executed his plans, and they toppled the British monarchy in the mid-17th century. When the New Model Army went into action, it was a true army. Yet once the war was over, the splintering began. There was no real unanimity of goals and methods during Cromwell's protectorate. Men knew what they had to do to survive on the battlefield, but in peacetime, the unifying enthusiasms, as well as the unifying fear of military defeat, disappeared. It is much the same today, except today's Christians have allegorized the language of battle. They have bled and died in the wars of humanistic imperialism, but they no longer understand or even recognize the validity of the legitimately Christian battle. They have spiritualized and internalized the Bible's language of warfare. They're not willing to step out into a real battlefield since they have never experienced boot camp. They are not fit for a war. Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago makes it clear that a war is on and that Christians are deeply involved. The same point is made by Kordakov's The Persecutor and Richard Wurmbrand's Tortured for Christ. In communist China, the persecution after 1949 may have been even worse, as Raymond de Jager's The Enemy Within indicates. Real battles, real life and death decisions are being made in real battlefields daily all over the world. Nevertheless, American Christians cannot recognize the signs of battle. They cannot even recognize the threat posed to them by the public school system. They cooperate. They go along. They worry about the allegorical battles, not the real ones. Whether or not a county allows the sale of alcoholic beverages is a major issue in the South's more rural counties. Whether or not to start a Christian school isn't for the vast majority of Baptists and Methodists in the South. They battle pink elephants while sacrificing their children, tuition-free, to the Moloch state. "Shoot a commie for Christ" is a slogan of ridicule used by secularists to impugn the motives of Christians. Yet the escalation of war tensions may make it necessary for Americans to be asked by their government to shoot a commie for America. They did in the Grenada invasion in 1983. They have been asked to shoot a Kraut for Britain twice in this century. What we take as a national duty, service to the humanist state, we regard as ridiculous in the field of religion. The holy wars of this century have been the most devastating, most ferocious wars in man's history. But the holy gods have been the humanist gods of the state and the party. Armies were once asked to go into battle in the name of a transcendental god, but whole populations today are called to self-sacrifice and self-immolation in the name of the Volk, the proletariat, and the fatherland, the chain of command. What modern Christians object to is the idea of an earthly chain of command. To some extent, the Mormons still believe in the idea, although I doubt that every Mormon has bought a year's supply of food for each member of the family, which is what they have been instructed to do. Roman Catholics acknowledge the legitimacy of a chain of command, but most of them practice contraception, the direct violation of the Pope's orders. In other words, even those who say they believe in a chain of command are willing to acknowledge its legitimacy only when the chain of command refuses to enforce fundamental law. This is a century of conformity to the state, not conformity to the church. Men will conform. It is a question of which agency or agencies will gain the subordination of the population. In Protestant circles, the chain of command has generally become mush because it is cut off at the top, as in Baptist and Congregationalist circles, or because it has become bureaucratized, the denomination. The people who have no real confidence in their elected elders, their seminary-trained pastors, and their collection plate-passing deacons. While some local churches may operate in rather strict conformity to the wishes of a dynamic pastor, this dedication is generally not transferable to his successor, indicating that there was no real chain of command anyway. There was only the strong personality of one leader, a leader who may have refused to delegate basic decisions to subordinates in the first place. Protestants are not used to exercising authority, probably because they are unwilling to accept the legitimacy of ecclesiastical authority. Any church hierarchy which attempts to exact conformity from recalcitrant members will face the inevitable competition of another church right down the street, which opens its arms to any disaffected member who will transfer his membership and his tithe, or what pitiful giving Protestants have substituted for a tithe. The competition is too stiff, and the competition has led to a least common denominator chain of command. What kind of army functions without a chain of command? None. Then what kind of army is the church? A defeated army. An army which is told that it must suffer defeat, that any sign of victory is an illusion, or else a lure into a subsequent defeat, that victory must be the devil's, will be a defeated army. Yet this is precisely what modern Christians have been told, and since they don't like the rigors of battle, and since they don't like the discipline of a chain of command, and since they really don't trust the judgment of their officers, they prefer to listen to stories of defeat. Defeatism justifies their own softness. And since they are guaranteed victory in the internal battles, they think, and since the external warfare is simply allegorical, they think, they can dismiss as ridiculous the idea that we really should be training as cultural soldiers, soldiers ready to do battle on the multitude of battlefields. The Supreme Commander. Jesus Christ is our Supreme Commander, but he operates only through his word, which is unquestionably a training manual. However, he has many interpreters, and few people see the Bible as a true training manual. There are too many one-star generals in a peacetime army, all building up their local empires, all jealously competing against their peers, and most of them completely unprepared for war. When the war comes, both superiors and inferiors recognize which generals are fit to lead, and the peacetime bureaucrats are rapidly removed from public scrutiny. Peacetime armies cannot tolerate men like Patton or even MacArthur in a shooting war. You cannot win without them, though. Field grade officers, majors, and colonels are numerous. A seminary professor is a light colonel. That's what Protestants have in large numbers. However, they all have the idea that they are generals, and if not actually generals, then at least they're as good as today's generals. They know for sure that nobody is about to follow them into battle, and so it really doesn't make much difference how good or incompetent they are. Nobody recognizes that the war is on because it's not a shooting war yet. Second lieutenants are, as always, as expendable as tent pegs and not much more useful. They are the deacons, seminarians, and elders in churches that are one-man bands. They know they are unprepared, and so does everyone else. Non-commissioned officers, such as Sunday school teachers, are ignored by everyone. They are assumed to be incompetent, but you need them in any bureaucratic system. We supply them with weak, corrupted materials, give them no training, and send them out to teach. To teach what? Well, whatever drivel pietistic evangelicals have published, or whatever socialistic, guilt-producing handbooks they have been issued by the denomination's liberals. The troops sit passively, confused, unaware that a war is actually in progress. They think their commanders are on top of everything. They don't even feel called upon to exercise minimal leadership, which is just what their superiors prefer. We have no strategists, so far as I can determine. How could we? We haven't won a major battle in this whole century. When was the last time a theological liberal was removed for heresy by any American church, other than by the Missouri Synod Lutheran, in this century? We have a few tacticians who have specialized in areas like starting Christian schools or battling against abortion or setting up small activist or publishing organizations, but their efforts are not coordinated and they seldom respect any single leader. Even communications are lacking. The groups seldom talk to each other. If we have any generals, nobody salutes them, especially bird colonels, who generally think that they are the true generals. The war. When war comes, persecution, a Soviet victory, rioting in the streets, more visible attacks on Christian schools, a gun confiscation law, an economic collapse, then the generals will appear. There will be leaders only when the followers see the strategic necessity of following. When external conditions make mandatory a chain of command, we will see its creation. We already have a reliable supreme commander. He knows what has to be done to win. His enemies cannot defeat him or his troops. When commanders who are capable of leading join forces with followers who trust their judgment and who are willing to sacrifice for the sake of the war, we will see the light, and books on the inevitability of external defeat will no longer be bestsellers. Psychological losers who don't understand the stakes of this war are the buyers of such books. They will not survive the first volley.